Product Breakfast Club. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Product Breakfast Club. This is Jonathan here, and it's one of those Jake-less episodes. They're always very sad, but you're just going to have to deal with it. And this episode is kind of cool because I had a very cool guest on, and this guest's name is Jason Pfeiffer. Oh, I should tell you what the Product Breakfast Club podcast is if this is your first time. Product Breakfast Club podcast is a podcast about the product world, the tech world, sort of product design, innovation, product strategy, product. And usually it's myself and Jake Knapp, the author of Sprint, just rambling away, talking about some tech and product topics. And sometimes we have some guests on. We've been on a bit of a roll of good guests recently. You'll have heard, or if you didn't, if you're new, Kevin Rose was on last week or the week before, depending on how this all comes out. Very professional, very unprofessional podcast, very messy, which is good because one of the biggest topics that we spoke about in this episode with Jason was about the topic of not being a perfectionist. So anyway, who's Jason? So Jason Pfeiffer is editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and the host of two really cool podcasts, which you should definitely check out. First one is Pessimist Archive, and this is so cool. This is a podcast about the history of unfounded fears of innovation, and it's basically talking about when new stuff comes out or when new innovations happen, how the world reacted to them. One of my favorite episodes is The Subway. This is basically about how people reacted to, you know, the idea of building subways and how they thought that there was going to be like demons and shit in those tunnels. I found that so cool. You should definitely check out that podcast. He also has a podcast called Problem Solvers, and really, really cool. It's about how entrepreneurs solve unexpected problems in their businesses. Both of these podcasts are a lot better and a lot more, you know, well-produced than Product Breakfast Club. But you know what? Whatever. So he was previously an editor at Fast Company, Men's Health, Maxim, Boston, and has written for New York, ESPN, Slate, GQ, New York Times. Is there anything that this guy did not write for? The Guardian, Washington Post. And he also co-wrote a novel with his wife called Mr. Nice Guy, which came out relatively recently. We spoke a lot about innovation, the topic of innovation in general. We spoke about, you know, perfectionism. We spoke about the fear of releasing things that are not quite ready. And a lot of tips and tricks and hacks. Well, mostly tips and tricks for entrepreneurs or want-to-be entrepreneurs. Now, I will say I only had exactly 28 minutes with Jason because he's a busy man. This is a busy man. Hello, I'm a busy man. So that's why at times I just blasted the questions at him and barely gave him a chance to speak. But it was really fun and I've learned a lot from it. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Jason Pfeiffer. And if you know what's good, you'll tweet this episode at him so he can retweet it and billions of more people. And on Instagram as well. So billions more people will come and listen to this podcast. Have a great one, everybody. Hey, Jason, how are you doing, man?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. So a huge amount of our audience is interested in the topic of innovation, but I also feel like there's a bit of confusion and a lot of sort of, I guess, messiness and muddiness about what it even means. How do you define innovation?
Huh, how interesting.
First question.
People always ask me how to define entrepreneur. They never ask me to define innovation. It's funny. It's innovation is everything, right? I mean, there's, I'm sure, some dictionary definition of it. But in the same way where we sometimes try to isolate tech in our lives and say, this is because of technology, or I'm interested in technology. Technology is everything, right? I mean, like everything, we're surrounded by technology. What are you talking about? And so to me, innovation means anything that has gone through the process of really taking a hard look at why something was happening in one way and then trying to improve upon it, where you're really genuinely looking to move something forward, regardless of what came before and whether you have any attachment to that thing, right? I mean, like sometimes I think that people harm themselves when they are trying to innovate because they get too attached to how something used to be. They feel like, oh, we have to preserve this or that thing. To me, true innovation means entirely forward-looking.
I think that's actually a really, really great definition. And I haven't really heard it being said like that before. And I think an interesting thing that I'd like to know is, like, how do you get away from what's there before? How do you get away from the legacy of what stood there before and start to think on a completely different path? Is that like a skill that some people have? Or are there like processes, or how does that actually happen?
I think that it's about habit. You know, we are the sum of what we've done before and what we've gotten comfortable doing. And I have found in my own life that the more that I challenge myself with uncomfortable questions, the more comfortable I get in doing the uncomfortable thing, the more comfortable I get in going into uncomfortable spaces. And I think that, you know, the more you do that, what you discover is that nothing bad comes of it. It's kind of like getting into it. And this here, I'm actually going against my own actions here because I hate cold water. But you know how when you get into cold water, it's like awful at first. It feels real. But once you're in it for a little bit, you adjust. And then you're like, oh, it's actually quite nice. I'm happy I'm in this water. And yet the process of getting in can be really uncomfortable. And so the thing that you need to do is do that over and over again enough so that your brain will assure you that there is comfort at the end of this discomfort, that it's worth going through. Because of course, if getting into the cold water meant that you would always feel that same shock as when you first touch the water, well, of course, nobody would do it. But you have to train yourself to understand that you will adjust to it and that it will be better on the other end, and that going through this discomfort is worth it. Now, I am very, very bad about doing that when it actually comes to cold water, but I've gotten pretty good at it when it comes to work.
Yeah, I really hate the... I've been trying to do this like Wim Hof method stuff, and I'm just like...
Oh, hell no.
Every time I try it, I'm like, no, I'm not having a cold shower at 7 in the morning. Fuck that shit.
No, I'm not having a cold shower anytime at all.
You mentioned, you know, like one of the ways to sort of create a habit is to ask yourself these difficult questions. Do you have any questions that you regularly ask yourselves, or know any questions that entrepreneurs who are innovative ask themselves, or what sort of questions do they have?
Yeah, I think those questions are often really hyper-specific to somebody's job. I mean, if you wanted to zoom out all the way, the question would be, why am I doing this? Why are we doing this, you know, as an institution, as an individual in your job? And if the answer is because that's the way that it's always been done, then that is a terrible answer. And that is the indication to you that there's got to be some better way to do this. And I do ask myself that on a fairly regular basis. A great example, and I'll try to make this story as short as possible. I started asking myself why I'm writing the cover lines on the magazine. So cover line is that's what we call like the headlines on the cover of a magazine.
Right.
And those are traditionally written by the editor-in-chief, or at least they're signed off on by the editor-in-chief. And every magazine that I've worked for, the editor-in-chief was the one who wrote those things. And so when I became editor-in-chief, I just started writing them myself. And, you know, I would show them to people and we'll sit around and look at them. But I was the guy who was creating them. I started asking myself, why am I doing that? Why am I doing that? And the answer is, of course, because that's the way it's always been done. So, okay, well, is there a better way, a way that might make me uncomfortable, but that is in fact better? And this thought occurred to me, which is that the cover of a magazine, if we want to really be honest about it, is not a piece of editorial. It's a piece of marketing.
Right.
Like the cover of the magazine is designed to sell the magazine. It's a piece of marketing.
Yeah.
So that means that the cover lines aren't editorial. The cover lines are marketing copy. And so now you've got an editor writing marketing copy. I don't know anything about marketing copy. I've never worked for a marketing company. Why the hell am I writing marketing copy? So once you start seeing it like that, you think, well, geez, somebody else should be doing this. So I contacted a huge advertising agency called Huge. If you've ever used HBO Go, that's them. And they loved this idea. I explained this whole thing to them. And I was like, I'd like you to write the marketing copy. And they had me come in and walk them through our whole process. And then they proposed, you know what, instead of just doing your marketing copy, why don't we reconceive of your cover entirely?
Mm.
And I, you know, at this point, now that's really uncomfortable to have this marketing company conceive of this editorial thing that I used to think of as editorial. But I said, yes. And we went through this amazing process and we completely redesigned our magazine cover because of it. I would have never gotten there. I would have never had the awesome design that I have on the newsstand every month if I hadn't challenged myself with this very uncomfortable question.
But how do you make space to actually challenge yourself to do those things? Because I find myself very often, and actually, I mean, the companies we work with are often in a very reactive state. And I think in a reactive state, it's pretty difficult to like take a step back and say, why am I doing it like this? How did you take a step back in that moment and sort of challenge yourself to think differently about what you were looking at?
Well, part of it comes from this idea that was plopped into my head by Tim Ferriss in a conversation that I had with him. Tim, I mean, can you go through a conversation without having bring up Tim Ferriss? So Tim,
every episode.
So Tim had told me, and this isn't, well, he had said that the last year of his life had been the most productive. And I said, why? And he said, because he had started asking himself, if this was easy, what would it look like?
Right.
If there was a better system to be had here, what would that be? And then he tries to build that system. And I really love that. I had been doing some version of that, but without consciously naming it. I'll give you an example. I come from, so, you know, magazines, as you may know, are not on the best financial footing. It is not an industry that has it all together. This is a media industry just in general. I'm not just speaking about entrepreneurs, I'm speaking about like the entire thing.
Right.
It's just like a wreck. Like we're just trying to reorient ourselves to a changing economy. So I have been through quite a change and I'm young, so I've only seen the back half of that change. So my first magazine job was in probably 2006 or something. Yet I was my first job out of newspapers. I used to work in newspapers. I came magazine. My first magazine job, I was editing 8 pages of a magazine every month. 8 pages. Like that is an insane thing right now, right? Where now I have my editors working on like the entire magazine, but my job was 8 pages. So how on earth did I fill my time when I was editing 8 pages working at this very large staff where everyone was like constantly busy? What was I doing? And the answer, when I look back on it, was that I was managing every little detail to an insane degree. So for example, the editor-in-chief of that magazine would come over and he'd be like, you know, I think that this caption on this photo on one of your 8 pages, it's like not working as hard as it could. It's not as funny or clever as it could be. So can you give me some options? And then I would sit there for the next like hour and a half and come up with 20 or 30 options. And then I would bring them to him and then he would circle one and then that would go in the magazine and off we go. That's how I filled my time. Now, you can do that when you have a gigantic staff of editors who are all like doing that. But I don't have that now. Entrepreneur is run with a very small team, a really awesome, amazing team of like superstars, but we are not many in number. And so I had decided, you know what? We are not focusing on those details. We're just not. We can't because they don't matter. That was busy work that we created because we were in a different economy and there were all these people and we were like, what do we do with all these people? And so we all started finding work for ourselves. But you know what? Not a single person in the history of magazines, I would posit, has ever bought a magazine or subscribed to a magazine because that little caption on that one photo was really great. Like nobody's ever done it. So why would we be spending time on that?
Yeah.
So I am always looking at things. So like this all comes back to that thing that Tim Ferriss said, because I constantly look at how we are operating. And I'm saying like, okay, what we need to do is get this to a place where we can functionally put out this magazine with this small amount of team that we have. And so that means like, what does it look like? If this were easy, what would it look like? Well, I'll tell you what it would look like. It would look like that we're not spending a lot of time on things that don't really matter. We're not spending a lot of time on captions. We're not creating these overly complicated pages that are super fun to make if you have a bazillion people working for you. But if you don't, you can't overtax the people that you have. You have to just start rethinking what is genuinely important and how can you do the best possible thing that you can with the resources available to you? And that is a mentality that you can start to apply to everything. So when I start to think about, for example, the cover lines, one, I'm thinking, why am I doing this? But also, frankly, I'm thinking like, is there just a better way to do this? Like I'm spending quite a lot of time sitting here and like gnashing my teeth over the cover lines, but you know, maybe there's someone out there in the world who would do a better job at this, who would just be more natural at this. And if there is, well, they should do it, not me. Like, I shouldn't do it just because editors and chiefs do these things. So that's what I'm constantly trying to put myself through. And I think actually that having squeezed resources and being reactive, it actually puts you in the exact right mentality to do this kind of stuff. It's when you're bloated and you're full of resources when you stop challenging yourself.
I 100% agree. And actually, speaking of Tim Ferriss, he also, first of all, the what would it look like if this were easy is a quote that I always have written at the back of my notebook because I think it's a really great question to ask yourself. And I think it's just a fantastic thing to stop and sometimes think about. I feel like I look for like the most difficult possible way to do things sometimes because it feels like more effort equals more results.
Yeah.
Another thing he actually added to that, or well, he added to it in one of his podcasts, and I think it's in the 4-Hour Workweek, was asking yourself yourself, if you could only work 4 hours a week, what would you do to bring the most value to your company? And this is something that I constantly ask myself as well as the CEO here. And it does help me to realize, wait a second, like, why am I editing this podcast? You know, I was thinking of doing that last year. Like, why the hell would I be editing this podcast? Like, why am I doing show notes? Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? Why am I doing this? And I think that a lot of people are overwhelmed and rarely get a chance to take a step back and think about what they're doing because they've just packed their lives full of so many things that are just like so unoptimized. So yeah, I'm really, really a big fan of that. What would it look like if this were easy? You mentioned the tiny details in the magazine, and that's a great segue for me to jump into one of the topics that I've seen you talk about, which I'm a huge fan of, which is perfectionism and not expecting perfectionism. And I think it's something that stops a lot of people from doing things or from getting started. Can you talk a little bit about perfectionism?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate in that I am just not a perfectionist.
Me neither. Messy.
I can't get myself into the headspace of somebody who is, but I can tell you, if you are a perfectionist, what it looks like on the other side. Here's what it looks like. It looks like that I put out an imperfect product because, first of all, there is no perfect product. So your only options are to put out the imperfect product and save yourself the time, or bang your head against the wall and try to put out the perfect product and then be disappointed when you have put out the imperfect product. Like, those are the only two options. It's not going to be perfect ever, right? ever. So it's like, do you want to take the quick path or the long path? So I put out the imperfect product, and then people like it. People like it. They like it, and maybe they have some complaints about it, which is fine. That's great. Tell me them, and then I'll make it better next time. But the learning process does not start until you have put something out into the world and then learned from it. You can't learn without doing. It's just not possible. Whenever I would meet with like students who are pursuing writing or something, and they'd ask me how to become a better writer, and the answer that I always give them is start writing and publishing things. I learned so much by just, like, I interned for some daily, like, community, tiny little newspapers, and I would write a story, and then it would be printed, and then I would read it, and I'd be like, oh God, like, you see it differently once it's etched on paper. And then I would learn from it. I used to read closely every single thing that I wrote because I was seeing it through the lens of a reader instead of through the lens of the creator. And that just changes everything. And so I think you need to put things out in the world, understanding that they're not going to be perfect, but that they can't be perfect, and that you will become better because they are out there. And so honestly, I value speed almost over anything else. I have these two podcasts, and what you're hearing is the first draft of every podcast, right? I mean, like, I basically write the script for the podcast and I produce it and I put it out there. And would it be nice to go through like 14 rounds of edits? Yeah, that would be nice. I don't have time for that. I don't have time for that. And I know that I will learn by creating and doing. So let's just do it. Let's just do it. Let's get it out there. Let's make a great product by making an inferior product and then learning from it. That's, to me, the only way.
It's so huge, and it's crazy that most of the successful people I speak to say the exact same thing. And yet in the world that I work in, which is the product design world and sort of product tech world, it's something that I need to repeat constantly to people, that it's not about getting the perfect version of this thing before you get it out there, because it doesn't actually really increase the chance of it succeeding. You need to see how things work on the market, because the market is what decides whether something is good or not. It's not you who decides what's actually good or not.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There are billion different variants of a thing that you could create. So there was this piece that journalists really loved that ran. It was written on Gawker, RIP Gawker, and it was like, I think the headline was "Against Editors," and the point of the piece was that editors don't always make something better. What they do is they just apply their own personal lens to it. And I really do think this is true. You could take a published piece in the New Yorker being like the most polished, edited, fine-tooth combed publication. You could take an edited piece that like ran in the New Yorker and hand it to a New Yorker editor and tell them that it was a first draft, and they would rip it apart and they would make all these changes to it, right? Which is to say that nothing is ever a finished product to everybody. Everything is always going to be some clay that could be molded. So you might as well just get it out there.
I love it. Is there anything that you do like that's like super perfectionist, like that's been made or done by perfectionists?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I don't know.
Like a sushi bar or something where it's like the best sushi in the world, where they spend like 10 days making, I don't know, one piece of rice.
I mean, there are things out there that I think are truly excellent and that I know a lot of time has gone into. Even certain podcasts, like This American Life, I think is a truly excellent product.
Right, right.
Serial, you know, their spinoff, a truly excellent product. I know that that goes through rounds and rounds and rounds and rounds of editing. I know that. And it's great. However, I wouldn't be surprised if you could strip out layers of editing and it would still be great.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that they probably needed to spend 50% of the amount of time that they did on something. I think it still could have been great because the talent is there and the ideas are there. And that's not to say that they shouldn't. If you have the money and you have the resources and that's your process and you're creating something that works really well, then go forth. Go forth. Who am I to stop you? But I wouldn't want someone who is thinking about starting a storytelling podcast to look at This American Life and see what they have and say, well, I shouldn't even begin to try because they have so many resources and this is their process and it can't be done without their process. Right. That's just not true.
But what about the fear? What about that sort of fear of doing things like that you'll be embarrassed, that your brand will be damaged? I think that's often the reason that people hold back, and especially the reason why companies and maybe these teams working on these podcasts, they're worried that they'll do something that's not like, you know, that's subpar, and it almost stops them from this kind of, you know, let's just try it approach.
I mean, it's true. You could put out something that kind of sucks and maybe people will be unhappy. Part of the reason that you won't do that is because you know your consumer really well and you're doing your research, and also that you're really transparent with them.
Right.
You're not like just tossing breadcrumbs to the birds and then the birds like come or they don't come, right? Like, you should be having a constant conversation with the people that you're serving. And so you should feel like you understand what they're looking for and that you can communicate to them that the things that you're doing are in direct response to what they're looking for. I'll give you an example. Descript, which is it's a product for podcasters. I love it. It was created by Andrew Mason, the founder of
Groupon. It's amazing.
Yeah. I can't live without Descript. I love Descript. What it is, very quickly for people who don't understand, is so its primary function is that it's a transcription tool. So you can upload audio and it'll transcribe it. And it's got great accuracy, like 95% accuracy. And that's not actually, I mean, they didn't even develop that. They're just using Google. But the interface is really excellent. And there are all sorts of fantastic tools that you can edit audio in words. So for example, if you have like a transcribed paragraph and you want to change the audio that corresponds to that, you could highlight individual words and delete them and it'll delete it from the audio. It's like amazing. And the thing that I love is that you can highlight text and export just that text as audio. So like just that sentence or two sentences. Anyway, the reason I bring up Descript is that they came out with like their update recently. Totally updated product, like completely different, looks different, feels different. And I got to say, buggy as hell. Like buggy as hell and annoying at times sometimes where like it'll crash on me. And like my favorite function, my favorite feature, that exporting, highlight and export, like that actually disappeared. There's like a workaround for it. And I emailed Andrew and I was like, where is that? And he's like, it's coming. But I got to tell you, as a user of Descript, I'm not annoyed. You know why? Because Descript has been really communicative that entire time.
Right.
They are showing you that they're being responsive to what people are needing. There were many improvements, even though it was buggy, and they're constantly updating and they're constantly telling me what's going on. And so here's my feeling. It sucks that they didn't get it right the first time, but this is a company that's listening to me and to people like me. That's my feeling. So that's great. I would rather them get the buggy product out and keep improving than to just like sit there chewing on their fingernails and not putting it out.
I agree. So Jason, we only have 3 minutes left before you have to go. So I'm going to like blast some very rapid fire questions at you.
Okay.
Because if I don't ask these, I'll get murdered by my audience. And this is for entrepreneurs and for myself as an entrepreneur. And maybe I'll just try to blast through these. What's like the most common piece of advice you give to entrepreneurs just starting out? Ridiculously vague question.
Yeah, I know. So ridiculously vague answer. Embrace change. Like just be a force of change within yourself. So like the thing that you're creating is going to be totally different. The kind of leader that you're going to need to be is going to be totally different. Everything about you is going to have to be different. And you are going to have to be okay with that and constantly look around for the signals of how you need to change. And that is the only way you'll get through this.
What advice would you give to someone who's feeling stuck?
Well, you know, I would rewind 10 minutes and listen to this part where we were talking about right. just getting things out there. I think that often people feel stuck because they don't have enough feedback coming in. They're like looking internally for feedback. But you know what? Sometimes your own well is dry. It's just dry. You like you drained it and you could sit there forever and it's not going to like fill back up with stuff that you can use. But if you put something out into the world or you start showing it to other people or you bring other people into the conversation, you will start hearing all sorts of ideas and that will fill the well.
Do you think there's a personality type that's better suited to entrepreneurship or do you think it's something that people can learn?
I think that it's something that people can learn. There are certainly people who are more naturally suited for it. I think that they tend to be creative, risk-taking people because you need both. But I think that entrepreneurship is also a pattern and a mindset, and you can acclimate to that. I wouldn't have thought of myself as an entrepreneur before this job, to be honest with you. I always thought of myself in a very narrow way, which was as a writer and an editor. And I was like creating fun stuff on the side. But now that I understand how entrepreneurs think and how they approach things and all the little mental tricks that they have to reevaluate what's around them and to see things as opportunities instead of just things, I have completely changed how I approach my own career. And I feel like I am a living lesson in how just immersing yourself in the world of entrepreneurship and getting to understand how people think and talk and act can really change how you do it too.
Amazing. Thanks so much. So Jason, I really appreciate your time and it is now right on the dot of 5:30. So I guess we got to let you go. And how can people find you online?
Yeah, so they can go to my website, which is jasonpfeiffer.com, J-A-S-O-N, F as in Frank, E-I, F as in Frank, E-R.com. There you will find it all. Links to my podcasts, Problem Solvers and Pessimist Archive. Sign up for my newsletter, which is a monthly blast of inspiration. You can reach out to me, find me on social, at Hey Pfeiffer is on Instagram and Twitter. And I love hearing from people, so reach out.
Yeah, dude. And Pessimist Archives is pretty much one of my favorite podcasts of all time. When's the next one coming out?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I actually have some great exciting news about Pessimist Archive, which is that for those who don't know, Pessimist Archive, it's a show, I call it a history of unfounded fears of innovation. So each episode is about the moment that a new piece of technology or innovation is introduced. And we try to understand why it freaked everybody out. So the car, the bicycle, the novel, chess, coffee, etc.
The novel is crazy.
Yeah, it's been great.
So crazy.
I love it. I love it. And it attracted a really awesome listenership. But it comes out very irregularly, which is the thing that everyone complains about. And that's because it's mostly my own project and they're very complicated episodes and they take a long time to produce. So yeah. I only get one out every couple of months. The news is that we got a nice chunk of cash from a very generous sponsor. And so that means that I can start spending on researchers and recording studios. And so the goal now is to get one out a month, roughly speaking, you know, and then hopefully we'll be able to scale it up from there after a while. So we're really rocking. I may be going into the studio for the very first time, which is to say like an actual professional recording studio to record Pessimist Archive, because I usually do it in my bedroom later today. So we're rolling.
Amazing. Great. So thanks so much, Jason, and have a great one.
Hey, thank you.
Oh, hello there, Jonathan. I'm back, and I hope you enjoyed that interview with Sir Jason Pfeiffer. I had great fun speaking to him. He speaks so quickly. This guy is just like so on it. You know what I mean? He's so not sleepy. Like the usual podcast kind of thing, not the guests that we have on here, but how we usually are. That's it. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know if you enjoyed it on Instagram or Twitter. I'm at J Ice Cream on Twitter. Jake is at Jake K on Twitter. And Jason Pfeiffer, he already told you all the things you need to know about finding him. And as always, we really do appreciate you helping us grow the podcast. And one of the ways to do that, of course, is by retweeting and posting this episode. Of course, tagging Jason Pfeiffer in it, because, you know, he's just got so many more followers than us. So let him know if you liked the episode. I hope you did. And we'll see you next Monday on the Product Breakfast Club. Bye-bye. Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club.